sometimes, in knowing what something is, it's just as essentially important to know what it is not. John Leland is the leader of the Virginia Baptist General Convention. And if it weren't for Leland, we would not have the First Amendment. And I would suggest to you we wouldn't even have the Bill of Rights. And so what has happened now is that Leland and the Virginia Baptist General Convention are refusing to ratify the Constitution because they believe that there is not a great enough protection for the religious liberty in the original draft of the Constitution. And now Leland has been tagged by the Virginia Baptist General Convention to be a delegate for the state of Virginia in the Constitutional Convention. But you see, Leland doesn't want that job. So Leland meets with one of his opponents and makes a deal with his opponent and says, look, I don't want to be the delegate, but you do. So I will make you a deal. And the deal is this. I will back out of this race, and I will endorse you. Now, you realize that the Virginia Baptist General Convention has the political power in Virginia. And who they choose to be delegate will most likely be the delegate. They've chosen me. But if I back out of this race and endorse you, that means that you will have the backing of your people and my people, which will guarantee you the seat as a delegate. But I will only make this deal with you for one condition. You must promise that you will do everything humanly and superhumanly possible to ensure that we have greater protections of religious liberty. And on a handshake, the history of the world changed. Now, that's not hyperbole or exaggeration, and I really mean that. The history of the world changed. Because very few people in America know John Leland. But I think that you could find that most people in America know John Leland's opponent, the man that he made the handshake deal with, and that is James Madison. James Madison agreed to represent the state of Virginia and ensure that we were going to have greater protections of religious liberties and liberty in general. And it would be James Madison who would make sure that we have the Bill of Rights. And this is the story that needs to be told. Now, just as a little side note, if you're interested in seeing an artistic rendition of James Madison's conversation with John Leland, there's an excellent movie called Magnificent Heritage. And in this movie, it's a black and white film. It shows this conversation between John Leland and James Madison and the deal that was struck. It is a very, very powerful movie, but you better hurry up and get it because I have heard that it's going to go out of circulation. You can still get it on the internet for about $20 a copy. And I do highly recommend it for anybody who is interested in knowing this bit of history. And so now understanding how we get to the argument of the Bill of Rights, we have to understand that there is a great debate. A great debate on whether we should have a Bill of Rights or not. And in this debate, we are going to isolate two key arguments represented by two key players. One I know you've heard of, another I'm not sure if you'd be so familiar with, but he's just as critically important to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as any of the other founders that we know. And so this debate for the Bill of Rights is going to be heard through the words of a man named Richard Henry Lee. Richard Henry Lee, if you'll remember from our history section, is the reason we have the Declaration of Independence. He is the presenter of the Lee Resolution, the legal act which created our states. And Richard Henry Lee is going to present the argument on our behalf on why we must have a Bill of Rights. The argument opposed to the incorporation of the Bill of Rights is going to come from Alexander Hamilton. Now, before we actually start casting lots to which side we choose, I want to make sure that you keep your mind open to both arguments. Because I'll sort of let a little spoiler out there. You see, I'm pretty sure you're going to find great merit with both sides of the argument. Now, the first we're going to hear from here is this pro, yes, we must have a Bill of Rights argument from Richard Henry Lee. And Richard Henry Lee, who many scholars believe is the writer of an anonymous set of letters called Letters from a Federal Farmer to the Republican, addresses this issue in the number 6 letter. And I want to share with you the reason why we need a Bill of Rights. Now, let me sort of let you know, in discussing the reason why we have a Bill of Rights, we are able to discern the purpose of the Bill of Rights. Now, there's a huge discussion on what is the purpose of the Bill of Rights. And that's why this debate is so important. Because in discussing why we must have a Bill of Rights, we understand the purpose of the Bill of Rights. And when we hear from Alexander Hamilton on why we should not have a Bill of Rights, we get to understand what the Bill of Rights is not. You see, sometimes in knowing what something is, it's just as essentially important to know what it is not. So we're going to start off with why we need a Bill of Rights so we can learn what is the purpose of the Bill of Rights. And the letter from the Federal Farmer, number 6, says this. Quote, the amendments recommended will tend to guard and direct the administration. Now, it's important for us to pause here for a second. So when we're talking in this text about amendments, it's not talking about the Bill of Rights. There are no amendments yet, okay? So when it's talking about the amendments, what it's talking about are the articles of the Constitution itself, the body of the main Constitution. And so what he's saying is the body of the main Constitution, as it is recommended, will tend to guard and direct the administration. But then he continues with this warning, and I quote, but there will be a danger that the people, after the system shall be adopted, will become inattentive to their amendments. Now, remember, Alexander Hamilton has told us in Federalist Papers 45 that the powers delegated to the federal government are few and defined. Those that remain in the states are numerous and indefinite. That the 10th Amendment confirms what Madison says in Federalist 45 by saying the powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And so the letter number 6 is telling us is, look, this limiting document, this original Constitution, which says if it's not been specifically delegated, it is reserved to the states. He says that is obviously a very limiting statement. But he says there's a danger that over the years we will forget that there are specified limits of the federal government. Limits being, if it's not been specifically delegated, you don't have it. And he continues in saying, their attention is now awake. The discussion of the subject, which has been already taken place, has had a happy effect. It has called forth able advocates of liberty and tends to renew in the minds of the people their true Republican jealousy and strongest guard against the abuses of power. But then he continues and says, fortunate it is for the body of the people if they can continue attentive to their liberties long enough to erect for them a temple and constitutional barriers for their permanent security. Now listen, this is very, very important, this statement. Temples and constitutional barriers for their permanent security. We're getting a clue on why we need a Bill of Rights and the purpose of the Bill of Rights. Constitutional barriers for their permanent security. How are they going to be constitutional barriers for their permanent security? Because they will be well fixed between the powers of the rulers and the rights of the people. So we're not only limiting the power of the rulers based on the original body of the Constitution, but we are fixing in between those a declaration of the rights of the people. He continues, and this is very important. They, the Bill of Rights, become visible boundaries, constantly seen by all. And any transgression of them is immediately discovered. See, that's the point here. A constant, visible reminder. Patrick Henry said that we should hold suspect anyone who approaches the jewel of liberty. You don't have to touch to approach. You can be approaching a long time before you ever touch something. And the standard here is to be a visible barrier that any transgression is immediately seen, any approach of government towards our liberty is marked immediately as suspect. And this next statement tells us exactly the purpose of the Bill of Rights. We know why we need a Bill of Rights now, to be a visible barrier, to be a constant reminder that these are the limits of government, but these are the rights of the people. But this is the purpose of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights serve as sentinels for the people at all times. What is the purpose of a sentinel? The purpose of the sentinel is to stand in the watchtower and cry alarm when they see the enemy afar off. You are a pathetically bad sentinel if you don't cry the alarm until the enemy is trying to knock down your door. And the Bill of Rights, as Patrick Henry said, is supposed to be keeping us on our toes. So as we see the enemy approach our liberty, we can cry out alarm. Don't wait until they're debating on the legislation. Don't wait until they're actually discussing the bill. The very moment that you hear a politician mention a common sense debate on gun legislation, the sentinel ought to be crying the alarm because they are approaching a shall not be infringed liberty. We must have a visible barrier so that if the government tries to come in and approach your liberty by redefining it or regulating or something like that, the very discussion of it should have us up and on our feet crying out alarm. So, what is the purpose of the Bill of Rights? To be a constant reminder to the people that government is already limited. And anytime government approaches your liberty, like way off here, liberty, government, they start moving in that direction. Alarms should be going off everywhere. Why do we need this? Richard Henry Lee says, they serve as sentinels for the people at all times, especially in those unavoidable intervals of inattention. Our framers, if anything, were studiers of history, and they had studied human nature. They knew certain truisms about human nature. They knew that people become pacified in prosperity. They become lazy in luxury. They become complicit and compliant in their comfort. And they knew liberty always brings prosperity, so we must guard against when people fall asleep. They will fall asleep. So in those unavoidable intervals of inattention, we need a constant visible barrier. A constant reminder to the people that, hey, this is a no-tread zone. We do not need the Bill of Rights to limit the federal government. Federal government's already limited. The powers not delegated to the United States are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. You can't get any more limited than that. But Richard Henry Lee tells us that we need a Bill of Rights to remind the people, to wake them when they fall asleep, and to keep government politicians from ever actually coming after and approaching our rights. So now let's talk about why we don't need a Bill of Rights from Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton tells us in Federalist Paper 84 that the Bill of Rights is dangerous and unnecessary. So let's talk about the dangerous aspect first. Alexander Hamilton says in Federalist 84, they would contain, meaning the Bill of Rights, would contain various exceptions to powers not granted. And on this very account would afford a colorable pretext to claim more than were granted. Listen, this is important. He says, for why declare that things shall not be done which there is no power to do? Remember, Madison has already written in his letter that we call Federalist 45. The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the states are numerous and indefinite. The powers delegated to the federal government will be exercised principally on external objects: war, peace, negotiation, foreign commerce. That's it. Few and defined, limited to foreign affairs. And then he says, everything else is reserved to the states. The lives, the liberties, the properties, the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state, all reserved to the states. So Hamilton already knows that the federal government is in a limited and defined box. We don't need to limit it anymore. And so what he's saying is, why do we have to make a new list to limit them when they're already limited? Why do we have to tell them not to do something when we've never delegated them a power to do it? Listen to what he says. Why, for instance, should it be said that the liberty of the press shall not be restrained when no power is given by which restrictions may be imposed? Why do we have to tell the government not to impose on our liberty of the press when we've never delegated them the power to do it? We've only delegated them foreign affairs, specifically war, peace, negotiation, foreign commerce, those types of things. There's no press authority in a foreign affair, a war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. So he's saying, why do we have to tell them not to do that when we've never delegated them the power to do it in the beginning? Remember, the powers not delegated are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. He says, if we make this list of things that they're not supposed to do, even though we've never delegated them the power to do it, he says the government might urge with a semblance of reason that the Constitution ought not to be charged with the absurdity of providing against the abuse of an authority which was not given, and that the provision against restraining the liberty of the press afforded a clear implication that a power to prescribe proper regulations concerning it was intended to be vested in the national government. He's saying, look, you're going to create a loophole. A loophole that the government will eagerly leap through. Because then the government will say, hey, you've made a really nice list. We like this list. We appreciate this list. We respect this list. We certainly will not be trampling on this list. But wait a minute. This thing over here is not on the list. And since it's not on the list, then it must be okay for us to regulate it. Because if you didn't want us to regulate it, you would have certainly put it on the list. Well, we know the powers not delegated are reserved to the states. But now we've created an avenue for the government to say, well, then why did you make a list if there were some things that we could and could not do? Not only that, they'll say, this is a really great list. We will certainly respect your list. But this thing you have on this list, this liberty of press, we certainly wouldn't want to abridge it. But how do we not accidentally abridge it? I mean, if we don't know what press is, we might accidentally do something we don't want to do. And so we don't want to accidentally abridge your liberty of press. Here's what we'll do. We'll define press for you. Hamilton says, what is liberty of press? Who can give it any definition which would not leave the utmost latitude for evasion? Because you see, the government will gladly say, we're going to define press because it puts the definitional powers in their hands. And they'll be able to say, look, this is not press. Because they didn't have this when our framers wrote this. This is press. We obviously had journalists. We had organized media. Anything that is corporate, organized, mainstream media. This is obviously journalism. If you're publishing for a magazine, if you're on the television, if you are writing for a newspaper that's recognized, if you're a member of the White House press corps, then you're obviously press because you're organized press. They had that back then. But you see, this over here, this can't be press because they didn't have press when they wrote the First Amendment. Not this, anyway. This internet thing. There was no internet when they wrote the First Amendment, so this is obviously not press. And since it's not press, it's not on the list, it must be okay for us to regulate it. And that's the very crux of Hamilton's argument. If you make a list, you will not be able to write down all your rights. And whatever you leave off that list will be argued as fair game for government to regulate. You will create an absurdity where they will use your very rights against you to regulate you out of the possession of your rights. Let's just review what he says again. What is the liberty of the press? Who can give it any definition which would not leave the utmost latitude for evasion? It's dangerous to have a Bill of Rights because you will not be able to write them all down and they will use the list against you. Not only is it dangerous, but it is unnecessary, Hamilton says. In Federalist 84, he says, the truth is, after all the declamations we have heard, that the Constitution itself, in every rational sense and to every useful purpose, a Bill of Rights. He's saying, look, your Constitution is a Bill of Rights, an unlimited Bill of Rights, because we have the federal government limited in its most capacity. If we have not told you specifically that you can do this, then you can't, which means everything else is our right. Remember? The powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. If we have not specifically told you you can do it, then it is absolutely something reserved to us. And then he continues with the very basis for our genealogy of the Constitution lesson. Remember that one that taught that there are five documents written over 700 years that created our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, and our Bill of Rights? Our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, our Declaration of Independence were not original documents. And here's Hamilton telling you the very lesson that I taught. He says, the several Bills of Rights in Great Britain form its Constitution. What were those Bills of Rights? The 1100 Charter of Liberties, the Magna Carta, the Petition of Right of 1628, the Grand Remonstrance of 1641, and the English Bill of Rights of 1689. Hamilton is telling us in Federalist 84, you don't need to make a new list because we have been making a list for 700 years. And that list is intended to be incorporated into this current constitutional contract. So how do we reconcile the two arguments? Remember James Madison? He made that deal with the Virginia Baptist General Convention and John Leland. So now Madison feels personally responsible for reconciling these two arguments. And he does that before the House of Representatives in 1789. He says, quote, "It has been objected also against a Bill of Rights." And then he quotes Hamilton's objection. Remember, it's dangerous and unnecessary to create a Bill of Rights. Because if you make a list, they will redefine the terms of that list to steal your liberties away from you. What is press? We'll redefine it, and then you won't have it without our permission. And he says, "This is one of the most plausible arguments I have ever heard urged against the admission of a Bill of Rights into this system. But I conceive that it may be guarded against. I have attempted it, as gentlemen may see, by turning to the last clause of the fourth resolution. Before the House of Representatives, James Madison offers up the most fundamental protection of our rights, so that the government can't say it's not on the list, so we can regulate it. So the government can't say we will define it, so we can regulate it." What was the last clause of the fourth resolution? I will mention to you that the last clause of the fourth resolution was actually incorporated into the Bill of Rights. It became the most important aspect of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Because without it, we are a kingdom. That last clause of the fourth resolution, the Ninth Amendment. "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." The most important clause in the entire Constitution and the Bill of Rights is the Ninth Amendment. It's what makes us a republic and not a kingdom. It's what says the government can't say it's not on the list. It's what reminds the people that the government cannot define your liberty. "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." No construing allowed. No redefining allowed. No allowed to say, not allowed to say, "Hey, this is not on the list." Not allowed to say, "This is on the list, but we're going to construe it to disparage or deny." That was the solution. It's interesting, though, isn't it? How many people in America even know the Ninth Amendment, much less know anything about it or how important it is? This is the essential protections of our liberties. The Bill of Rights, not a mechanism to limit government, but a reminder to the people that they are the greatest limitation of government. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. You are the greatest control on the government. You are the greatest protector of your own liberty. But if you don't know what your rights are, how are you going to defend them? If you cannot define your rights, how are you going to defend them? And that's the purpose of the Bill of Rights. So we never, ever forget. Problem is, we don't teach this. That's why this lesson is important. Because that sentinel within the Bill of Rights has been screaming for decades that the enemy approaches. And because we don't know what our rights are, it's nothing but a silent alarm. Now, do not forget, after this lesson, to move on to the understanding of the 10th Amendment, the protections and the protectors of our liberties. That lesson builds on this one. Thank you, and God bless.